Welcome to Inside Economics. I'm Mark Zandi, the chief economist of Moody's Analytics, and I'm joined by a group of my colleagues, my two co-hosts, trusty co-hosts, Chris Derides and Marissa DiNatale. Hi, guys.
Hey, Mark.
Mark, happy
Thursday. How are you guys doing? Happy Thursday. This is a rare Thursday taping of the podcast. We normally do this Friday. Why did we do this on
Accommodate my travel schedule.
Oh, where are you headed?
To Philadelphia for the All Hands Day, but I'm going tomorrow.
Yeah, we have our All Hands Day next week. So you're coming early.
Yeah, I'm coming early to see friends over the weekend, and then I'll see everybody
all of us
on Monday.
Everyone going to be there?
We got
I should say we also have Chris Lafakis and Matt Collier. You see how well I did that, Matt?
Collier. Nailed it.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
You'll be there. Chris, yeah. Mr. Lafakis, you'll be there as well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Wouldn't miss it.
Good. It should be good. This is our second All Hands Day since we went fully remote, or we've been fully remote since the pandemic, but officially fully remote. I think this is number two, right? Isn't that the second one?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And I was just talking to Carl, my brother, and he was saying, who runs the joint, and he was saying, you guys have big parts, don't you? You, Chris and Marissa, you have big parts in this thing. He's got a big question.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's going to put us on the spot, right?
Right. What's the world going to look like in 20 years? Not next year. Not 10 years from. I go, Carl. Why 20 years? Why not 10? He goes, well, 10's too soon. I go, really? Okay. Very good. Well, safe travels.
Thank you.
Yeah. I just flew.
I guess
today.
I'm the only one here traveling.
I flew today from San Francisco. I was on a plane.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
With no internet, which is
beautiful.
Right. Is there ever reliable internet on? I have yet to actually purchase internet on an airplane and have it work.
No.
To the point where I can work.
Really?
Oh, you're making
never,
that up.
Ever.
No, ever. That's not true.
Usually it works very well.
Yeah, it works very well.
Like you can get onto VPN and you can.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've never had that successfully happen.
I can simulate
American
the macro
Airlines.
Model. No, I've never had a problem. Maybe it's those planes that fly out of LAX. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, well, this is a big week, right? We got the consumer price index for the month of March, CPI, a really important statistic in the context of, well, everything. And it was a bit disappointing, wasn't it, Matt?
Yeah, it was. It's how
especially for you. It was really disappointing.
Actually, for you.
For you in particular, personally, it was very disappointing.
Yeah, I've come to terms with it, I think.
I haven't.
Okay.
I tweeted out. I was so confident in your point two. Uh-huh. You're going to have to explain what I mean by point two. But anyway, tell us about the report. You know, why was it so disappointing?
And I'll say, too, I made the mistake of reading the comments to that Twitter post of yours, which was not wise.
See, I never do that.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it again. Yeah, but jumping into it, the headline CPI in March rose 0.4%. The forecast, consensus forecast was for a 0.3% increase. So hotter than expected again, which is a familiar story in 2024. The annual rate, the 12-month rate for headline CPI rose from 3.2 to 3.5%. I would say that that's maybe a little overstated. There are some base effects. Even if CPI came in as we expected, it still would have lifted the annual rate. But nevertheless, disappointing report. Prices were moderating gracefully in 2023. That seems to have stalled at the start of 2024. Moving into kind of some of the big components. Energy price.
Core? What was core?
Core rose 0.4% as well.
Core meaning ex food and energy, which is kind of, we look at that because that gets to, we think, sort of the underlying trend in inflation.
Right. And that's one because it's the underlying trend. And it's also the more painful spot here because that was the 0.2% you're referencing. That was the forecast that we put out that was a little bit lower than consensus. Consensus was at 0.3, a lot of rounding up. So very close to 0.2, but 0.3. And we'll
0.2, just for the listener, the difference between 0.2 and 0.3 is like night and day. It's,
right.
I know I'm giving you a hard time, but you'll thank me for it 10 years from now.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. So if
So let me ask you this, Matt. So CORE came in at 0.3 into the second significant. Was it? No, point, was
no, point it, four.
Point four. I'm sorry, point four. Consensus was 0.3,
mm-hmm.
and we were at 0.2. And can I also ask on the 0.4, was that rounded up to 0.4? Do you know?
Yeah, we were
rounded up, I think. Okay.
0.36. I don't, 0.36 was the
or something like
was
that.
To the second digit.
You see what we've come to. We're focused on the second and third significant digit here. But anyway,
right.
So can you just get, I'm just, this is really instructive. Why did we think it was going to be 0.2 and it came in at 0.4? You know, what was, explain the difference. You know, what was the error?
So there's the big components that go into CORE CPI. Shelter famously has been slow to moderate. So we expect rent prices to come down and they
But hold on. That wasn't the cause of the error. Because you
know,
right?
Yeah, we're nailing that. So so it's the question: why did I come in at 0.2?
Yeah, why did we say 0.2 and the actual was 0.4? You know, what was the reason for the difference?
The biggest is auto insurance.
Let me put it another way: you screwed up.
Sure,
okay? Screwed up.
Right.
And I want to know why.
It's right. Well, I'm yeah, okay. Doing gymnastics to minimize. I'm doing gymnastics to minimize the mistake, but the. Biggest is auto insurance. Auto insurance is
okay.
Jumped by 2.6%, which is bigger than any monthly increase during, you know, supply chain crunch in 2021, 2022. Insurance premiums, if you look back to 2019, are 40%-ish higher than late 2019. Car prices are about 20-25% higher for new and used vehicles. So there's this expectation, especially after some moderation in February, that auto insurance, and this goes to auto repairs too, makes sense why they tracked for a while, but there's this expectation it should start to roll over now that they've kind of, premiums represent what insurance companies have to pay out now that cars cost more. So that 2.6% increase, even if you don't hear a lot about the CPI for motor vehicle insurance, mouthful as it is, but it is a big part of household budgets. It gets a big weight. We thought there would be an increase, but a much more modest one. We're about 2 percentage points low. And that's the bulk of our forecast miss, which is, I think, plagued a lot of people. But that's, about half of our miss on CPI.
Oh, go ahead, Marissa.
I mean, do you know how important it is in the to CORE?
To CORE,
like
I'm
it's that big of a weight that it. That.
A little over 3.5% would be my guess. It's 2.5, so, I think,
well,
for headline.
Yeah, I think it's 2.5 in the total. So
yes.
The CORE would be
so maybe a little
3.5, maybe.
Yeah. I guess 3.5, but I would say between 3 and 3.5.
When I say 3.5, so the listener, 3.5% of the index is of the CORE CPI index would, and we're making that up, but roughly right. 3.5% of the CORE CPI index is the cost of
auto insurance,
vehicle insurance. And then if you throw in vehicle repair,
mm-hmm.
which is also, I think, part of the error.
Right.
Yeah, I think you're now closer to almost 6% of the, 5.5% of the index, yeah. A CORE CPI index, something like that. So it's
right.
Small, but it's not inconsequential. And when you get a big number, big increase, and you do the multiplication, it adds. It's not tenths of basis, a tenth of a percentage point, but it's enough of a basis point difference that explains, you know, 0.2 rounded down versus 0.4 rounded up. You know, mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but this conversation is quite interesting in the sense that it shows you how we're parsing the data here, mm-hmm. Parsing the data very finely to understand what's going on.
You know, the old joke about economists and sense of humor, right?
Yeah. What's the joke?
How do you know an economist has a sense of humor?
How do you know?
They use a decimal point.
Oh, that's right.
So imprecise. Difficult. But we're going out to the second.
I forgot that joke. That's a good joke. Yeah, it's a very good joke. And true. Very true. I was going to say, what was I going to ask? Oh, but, you know, my proclivity is to think that inflation's coming in and I look at that data and I think to myself, well, and I think you mentioned this, it's the cost of vehicle insurance and maintenance is very closely tied to vehicle prices, right? So vehicle prices are higher and they surge during the pandemic and for new vehicle prices that up until this past couple months, they've been surging, then the high vehicle insurance and maintenance costs reflect those higher vehicle prices. So if vehicle prices start falling, that would suggest, obviously with a lag, that it should take some steam out. It will take steam out of the cost of insurance and maintenance. Is that roughly right?
Yeah, I think so. And it makes the acceleration that much more surprising that the catch up has happened and it is a lag, but it started to show signs for auto insurance, this signs of moderation. And now there's this big, strong pickup in March, which was definitely a surprise.
In vehicle prices, both new and used, fell in the month of March, right?
Right. So used vehicles fell about 1.1% from February to March. They're down almost 2% relative to a year earlier. New vehicles fell again, and that's five of the past 6 months, monthly declines in new vehicle prices. And they're about flat when you compare them to a year ago. So hard to argue, unless insurance premiums were really undercounting some kind of risk in their payouts for claims, that this divergence between a 40% increase in insurance premiums and a 20% increase in cars, there's kind of reasonable to expect that gap won't continue to widen. So the increase in March, yeah, it stinks and it explains the big forecast miss, but I don't think representative of, you know, kind of more cyclical consumer spending type of inflation that really concerns Federal Reserve and predicts is a lot more persistent.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, the listeners, people are listening to this and, you know, really into the weeds, and I may not be exactly following along with everything we're saying, but the bottom line here is the difference between the 0.2 and the 0.4, hair on fire, markets are selling off, people are changing their forecast for the Fed. If it came in at 0.2, it'd be the exact opposite. The market would be taken off, lots of green, bond yields would be falling. And you're saying to me, and this is how am I hearing it, that the difference between the 0.4 and the 0.2 is vehicle insurance and maintenance costs, and those things probably should be declining and probably will be declining in the not too distant future because they're tied ultimately to vehicle prices, and they are now falling, and they're falling more fundamentally. So, right? Do I have that wrong?
I agree with the explanation of bad, but no reason to, it's not a 3-alarm fire.
What about a 2-alarm fire?
There's one fire alarm going off, I would say.
Even turn on the alarm, but okay. Right. You're saying one. Okay. Well, that's instructive. Okay. So there's one other point about this. You have made to me in email conversations is the difference between the way vehicle insurance is calculated in the CPI, the consumer price index, and the way it's calculated in the consumer expenditure deflator. And just for the listener, it's the consumer expenditure deflator, another measure of inflation. That's what the Fed ultimately is looking at when setting policy. Their target is 2% inflation on the core, excluding food and energy, consumer expenditure deflator. So what's the difference there what are the numbers like?
So the direct mapping for what goes into the PCE deflator, the inflation measure that the Fed targets, actually comes from the producer price index that has as granular detail as the consumer price index, but for businesses. So we see intermediate products, final and demand products, the stuff that businesses pay to each other to make their goods and services. And the PPI for auto insurance is what gets mapped and goes into the PCE deflator. And that rose just 0.1% in March. We got that data this morning. That's a significant difference from the 2.6% increase in the CPI's measure of auto insurance. And there's already been this widening between CPI, more specifically core CPI and core PCE, in a way that's made the Fed a little bit more calm about these hot CPI prints because it's not what they're focusing on. And I think not just shelter, but now what we see with auto insurance are two factors that juice the CPI report, but don't necessarily translate into a PCE deflator and could potentially or are likely to widen this gap that we see between the two and make it not so simple to say inflation has stalled entirely or is reaccelerating, because the other measure is not subject to the same type of you know, jumps like we've seen in the CPIs.
Do you know offhand, Matt, you said the PPI is being used for the consumer expenditure deflator. What is the Bureau of Labor Statistics using for the CPI when they measure vehicle insurance? Do you know?
That's a good question. I don't offhand. Yeah,
can you find that out? Well,
for sure.
Next time. Because that's a big difference, 0.1 versus 2.6. The CPI measures 2.6% increase. The PPI measures 0.1. It's a big difference.
I wonder if that kind of suffers from the same thing we've seen with shelter inflation, right? Is this long lag to kind of incorporate more current changing conditions into the CPI? I mean, when you buy a vehicle or you get auto insurance, usually you're doing that once a year, or once every 6 months, that your rate might change. So I wonder if there's a similar timing component with that as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, we should, Matt, maybe you can investigate that too. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. So we now have the consumer expenditure deflator coming up. That's going to be released. Is that next week? Next Friday?
Two weeks. Later than usual in a month.
Okay. And now we have CPI for the month of March. We now have PPI for the month of March. What do those two things imply for the consumer expenditure deflator for March? It's going to be released in 2 weeks. Do you have an estimate for that?
Early estimate is 0.3%, if we're just rounding to one decimal point, 0.3% growth for both the PCE deflator and the core PCE deflator. We have a good amount of input data and understand how the PCE weights certain things. So that'll be the expectation now. And again, we're talking tenths of the percentage points, and that's a more encouraging.
Okay, if you go to the second, digit, what is it?
On the low side, so I want to say we're rounding up from 0.27. We would round up to 0.8 or to 0.3 for the core PCE. So there's a bias towards the lower end. So maybe I'll talk myself into rounding down again and stick my neck out there.
Don't do it, Matt. Don't do it.
For all the nice people on Twitter.
You did notice on my Twitter feed, by the way, at Mark Zandi, just saying, I did call you out. I said my crack team of economists.
Yeah.
That's you.
Sure. I like it.
Sure. You and Justin and the team. But I jest, of course. I mean, forecasting this stuff month to month is crazy, crazy hard. There's so many variables and moving parts and, you know, and the difference, as we pointed out, between 0.2 and 0.4 is like, yeah, you know, boils down to who knows what. So very difficult to do. Any other component of the CPI release that surprised you, both, let's say, on the upside or the downside? Let's begin with the upside. Any other component surprise you?
On the upside, I think, surprising or not, I think it's a good story. And that's when you kind of lump in grocery prices, new and used vehicles, which we touched on, airfares, hotels, these, you know, they're cyclical. They're, when consumers are lining up to buy these things, prices get bid up, and consumers line up to buy those things when they're taking home stronger wages. So they are a proxy for the kind of demand that's really hard to bring out of the economy. And in those elements and across those categories, prices were either flat or declined, as we saw with new and used vehicles. I think that's a positive story. On the negative side, which has its own implications for the PC deflator, but medical services, it has a 0.6%. We have a 0.6% increase in March, which was a little bit above our expectations. Not a huge miss, but it's given a lot of weight. It's more the trend and then kind of the underlying dynamics in healthcare that I think make it one of the few components that we're forecasting stronger growth in 2024 than we did in 2023, marginally, but most things are moving the other way. Kind of structural stuff. Healthcare prices are set far in advance. It's very labor intensive. Hospitals, nurses, hospitals had a really hard time staffing their operations, famously. And those increased labor costs are starting to flow more and more into prices. So I think you're going to see pretty sturdy medical care or healthcare inflation over the next year, and it's getting significant weight. So I think it's going to come under a lot more scrutiny. And I think we see that in March with a 0.6% rise. So those are two things that I would touch on.
Yeah, and just as a point of interest, the the weight of medical care in the CPI is lower, much lower than it is in the consumer expenditure deflator, the PCE deflator, right? Because the CPI is out of pocket and we tend to use insurance and other things. And so it has a smaller rate in the CPI. Okay. Marissa, anything in the CPI report that you want to call out that, you know, that Matt didn't focus on?
I mean, we mentioned shelter. It's mm-hmm. good that it didn't accelerate, I guess. You know, it's mm-hmm. just hanging in there. It's not coming down. It's not accelerating.
It's coming down. It's still coming down. No, I think it's coming down. No.
The rate of growth went down.
Huh? Right?
The rate of growth for rent.
The rate of growth, yeah.
0.5 to 0.4. So, yeah.
It's slowly moving. It's moving. Okay. Right?
Mm-hmm.
No?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll
take it.
Yeah. 0.4 is lower than 0.5. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. All right. Okay.
Yeah. But it's still too strong. And too we still are not seeing this, right, real definitive slowdown that we're hoping to see. And it's still 60% of the change in CPI every month. So
it's a big part of the story. Why it's still
a big part. It's the biggest part of the story still. Right. So that's where we really need to see the movement.
Right. Right. Chris, can you just, you know, we've done this ad nauseum, but it's so complicated. I keep forgetting, you know, exactly. How do you explain, what's your favorite explanation for why it's taken the cost of housing services to slow down? It's slowing. It's moderating. Continues to moderate, but very, very slowly, more slowly than one would expect based on historical leads and lags. What's your pet explanation for, you know, what's going on there?
Pet explanation. It's I guess we're talking about rent of primary residence specifically versus the owner's equivalent rent. I
think both.
Okay.
Yeah. So, right.
So just on the rent, you know, straight up rent should be easy to measure. I think it is, but I think we have some compositional issue, right? A lot of rental is on the lower end, perhaps. And that is a part of the market, a segment of the market that continues to have some significant demand. So it's possible that that's preventing that rental growth from receding as fast as we might see on the, when we look at market rents. I don't know. It comes down to how the sampling would be done. This, you know, rents only change once a year typically. So there's some lags here in terms of how those rental effects are incorporated in the CPI. The owner's equivalent rent, and we've already talked about this in the past, I think that has more methodological issues just in terms of how you estimate a rent for someone who's owning their own home based on rental properties in their similar market. You can try to control for other factors, but it's still, at the end of the day, a pretty complicated process. And I don't think we have sufficient data in a lot of markets to really nail that down properly.
So the way I articulate it, and let me do it and tell me if I've got this right, is we've got an affordable housing shortage. We've got a very severe shortage of homes at lower price points for lower rent. High end of the market, not so much less so, particularly in the rental market. We've got a lot of units coming on. Vacancy rates are rising. Rents are a lot weaker. But we have a lot of weakness at the low end, a lot of strength at the low end because of the shortage. But when the BLS goes and tries to calculate, in some many markets, there isn't enough variety in the housing stock in the areas that they're looking at, that they're using the rental measures for the affordable part of the market for the rest of the market, and therefore it's making it look like rents are across the market are stronger than they really are. Did I get that roughly right?
That's right. And for the owner's equivalent rent.
For the owner's equivalent rent. Yeah.
I think that's right. I think that's a reason to explain why that's been stickier than we might have expected. The rent of primary residence, though, is a bit different, right? There we don't have that issue. We're just counting.
Right.
So there it could be the compositional effect again, that they're just is more demand at that lower end of the market, and that's skewing the overall picture. But
yeah,
it's more the, I guess the mystery is, why is that so persistent relative to what we're seeing on new leases, right? If you look at all the other market data, new leases are flat to even down in certain markets, right? Apartments, even single family homes, are much weaker than what we'd, what this CPI would suggest.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, the way I kind of frame this conversation around house, the cost of housing and what it means for overall inflation is, we've been talking about the so-called harmonized CPI. The harmonized CPI excludes owner's equivalent OER. And in fact, in many other parts of the world, particularly in Europe, the statistical agencies there don't include OER because they throw up their hands and say, we can't measure this. It doesn't provide any real information. It's not useful as a guide towards inflation. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been publishing a harmonized CPI now for some time on an so-called experimental basis. They're not, you know, out there. It's not in the, I don't think it's in the press release, but you can Google it. You can say BLS, harmonized CPI. And if you look at the harmonized CPI, this was going to be my statistic for the game. But I'm going to give it up right now. If you look
at, gotten it.
Oh, well, let me ask the group, in another way, what do you think harmonized core, meaning ex food and energy, harmonized excluding OER CPI growth year over year through March was? What do you think that was? Anyone?
1.9%.
Yeah. 1.9.
Is that right?
That's exactly right.
That was a guess. Very good.
Was it a guess?
You said it was. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. 1.9.
I mean, it was an educated guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been 2-ish or below for more than a year. And this is on the CPI, not on the consumer expenditure inflator, right? So that is below Fed target. So the only thing keeping inflation, core inflation, underlying inflation from the Fed's target or below the Fed's target is the growth in the cost of housing services, which we all kind of in one way or another are saying we can't measure it. Anyone want to disagree with that comment? No? You agree?
We can't measure it well.
We can't. You can't measure it well enough so it provides any information that's useful, in, particularly in terms of understanding what's going on with inflation and how monetary policy should be set. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Disagree with that? No.
What about super cores rise of late?
Who cares? I mean, everything else is, this washes out. Things go up, go down all around. Okay. But we want to get to the fundamental question is, what is underlying inflation? What is, abstracting from the vagaries of the data, the volatility in the data, methodological issues, what is underlying rate of inflation? And I would posit the best measure of that is core, the harmonized core CPI. That feels like to me the best benchmark of underlying inflation.
So Mark, if someone gets a new loan and it's 6% or 7% and their cost, their monthly mortgage payment is elevated relative to the other guys that got in at 3 or 4%. We have to include that in the overall inflation estimate, right? I mean, it's a cost.
I'd say, Chris, if you could do that well, I'm all in. If you can't do that well, you're just screwing things up. You're just messing with things. You're obfuscating what's going on underneath. So I'd say we want to get a measure that we feel confident in is giving us a sense of underlying inflation. And that to me is saying we're there, we're there. I don't hear any strong objections to that. No. Okay. All right. You're not convinced. And of course, I'm expressing is certainly not the consensus view. I don't think.
I don't think so. I think the Fed is looking more at super core and core.
Well, here, this is what I get irritated about this whole you know, people say, and I won't call out names, but, you know, other economists, they get mad, they get annoyed when you start saying, don't include this, don't include that, right? They say, you're just cherry picking. Yeah. And then they go, well, what about Supercore? I go, come on, what are you talking about? It's like, come on. I find that really annoying, you know, highly annoying. Anyway, I'm just trying to find the truth here, guys, right? Trying to find the truth.
The speaker of truth.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know, you heard Chris Lefakis's voice, and we brought Chris on because something we haven't talked about yet, but the thing that worries me the most about inflation and the economy going forward is energy prices, oil prices more specifically. And they have moved up quite a bit, and they contributed to top line inflation. And that, you know, it has lots of implications for Americans. You pay more at the gasoline pump. In fact, I think, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, but you go back a year ago or so, we were kind of in the, for a barrel of oil, in the 70s, firmly in the 70s, probably the low 70s. Now we're in the high 80s, you know, somewhere around there. The question is, Chris, you know, what's behind this run up in oil prices? And should we be fearful that we're going to see further increases in oil prices going forward here? So what do you think?
Yeah, so I do think that we will get an increase in consumer energy prices, regardless of what happens to oil prices, just because of seasonality. We are entering a period of high demand in the Northern Hemisphere. And if you look at crack spreads, so-called crack spreads, these are the difference between wholesale petroleum product prices like diesel, jet fuel, kerosene, motor gasoline, and oil prices. These typically expand in the summer driving season, and the effect is significant. It could add as much as 20 or 30 cents per gallon to the price of the pump. So even if oil prices kind of stay where they are right now, on a national basis, we are at $3.63 for a gallon of gasoline. That's as of today. We're recording this on April 11th. And if you add that 20 to 30 cent increase, seasonal increase in the crack spread, just those two factors alone, if oil prices stay where they are, we're going to get awfully close to $4 per gallon nationally. And there's some states that will absolutely breach that threshold. And that's a very important psychological threshold. Mm. So we are going to flirt with that. I think in the summer month, you'll absolutely see some states will go above $4 per gallon. The hope is that it is temporary. We do believe that it will not be a persistent increase on a national basis because we expect oil prices to come in, not by a lot, but maybe $2 to $3 from where they're currently at. And I'd be happy to talk about why oil prices have increased and what our outlook is
You do that, because you brought it up. So what you're saying is oil prices today are $85 to $90 a barrel. WTI, West Texas Intermediate, is $85. Waving my hands here. $90 on Brent. And at that $85 to $90, right now we're at $3.63 for a gallon of regular unleaded. Even if oil prices stay where they are, which is what we're expecting, but even if they stay there, you're saying gasoline prices, cost of gallon of regular unleaded is going almost to $4 over the next couple, 3 months. That's what you're saying.
Yes, in some states, definitely we'll reach that threshold. And nationally, we're going to get awfully close. And perhaps there's going to be a day or two where we do get over $4 just because of the day-to-day fluctuations in oil prices, retail, and crack spreads. So we're going to get awfully close to that $4 threshold nationally, and certainly we'll reach it in some states.
Yeah. Okay. And going back to then oil, why were prices so much? I mean, I think the surprise last year, and this was one of the reasons why the economy did as well as it did, surprisingly, was oil prices were low. They actually fell for much of the year. I think we were firmly in the 70s on WTI and Brent, and now we're in the high 80s. What happened? You know, what's going on?
Well, I think we can thank U.S. shale producers. They had a banner year. Prices are still above their break-even cost of extraction. Interestingly enough, we just got a data point from the Dallas Fed. Every year they conduct their energy survey, and in March they ask a special question to all the producers in the state is, at what price can you profitably drill? At what price of WTI can you profitably drill a new well? We were expecting that cost to increase. It was $66 in the Permian Basin last year in last year's survey, and now it's gone up to 70. So that is an increase, and it's just like we're talking about, well, it costs more to make a house, it costs more to make a car. You have to pay workers more, and it costs more for equipment and police rigs to in order to establish new sources of production as well. And that's where the $4 increase in the Permian Basin comes from. In the Permian, by the way, it is the marquee place to drill and provider of the marginal barrel of oil on the global market. So that has increased. But still, if you compare 70 to where we're at right now, 85 for WTI, it's still profitable for U.S. Drillers to establish new sources of production. And I think I've gotten a little bit more optimistic over the last month or two on the U.S. Capacity to bring new barrels online because prices have risen. And part of that is because OPEC, what OPEC has signaled. But that should help us to put a cap almost on oil prices, or at least prevent them from going over $100, barring some kind of geopolitical catastrophe.
So you're saying really the swing producer here is the North American shale producers, the frackers. Last year in 2023, they ramped up production dramatically. As I recall, they increased production by about 1 million barrels per day to over 13 million barrels a day. And just for context, the globe produces and consumes a little over 100 million barrels a day. 13 million, that's a record high. And that's higher than anyone else on the planet. I think the Saudis are now, because of their cuts, down to, what, 8-9 million barrels a day, something like that.
Nine, yeah.
And they were able to do that last year because they kind of took out of mothballs a number of wells that they had started but never completed. But they completed them and produced a lot of oil, and that helped. That all that oil came onto the market more than offset the production cuts by the Saudis and the effects of the sanctions on Russian oil. We had a surfeit of oil, and that kept prices down. But here we are today. The North American producers are still ramping up production, but that not nearly to the same degree. And we're still getting more global demand. Global demand continues to improve for oil. Is that roughly right?
Precisely. And all of that growth in global oil demand is coming from emerging markets. So if you look at OECD countries, oil demand in those countries is relatively flat.
Or here in the U.S., it's been down, right? Is it even rising here in the U.S. now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can cherry pick beginning and ending points, but yeah, you could say that.
Right.
That's just industrialization of emerging market economies, you know, India, China, Southeast Asia. And that train has left the station. So every year we need to come up with an additional 1 to 1.5 million barrels of supply. And the U.S. carried the bulk of the load in 2023, but they did that by drawing down on their inventory of uncompleted wells. These were wells that were started maybe during the pandemic, but were not completed. And what I mean by that is you can drill a hole, but it's not going to produce oil until you frack it. And fracking it is actually 2/3 of the cost of establishing production. So if you just drill the well and then you don't do anything with it, you can keep that as kind of inventory, you have to pay Baker Hughes or Halliburton or companies like this in order to frack it. And that's 2/3 of the cost. So they've been reducing their inventory of drilled but uncompleted wells substantially in 2023, and actually, right now, we're at the lowest levels of inventory on record. And that series goes back to 2014 for drilled but uncompleted wells. So the theory is that U.S. production will slow because now all of a sudden you have to come up with an extra third of the cost in order to establish new production.
Did I hear you right? The so-called DUCs are at a record high? I thought we worked those
record
down.
Low.
Record low. Okay, fine. Okay.
Roughly yeah, they're lower than they have been at any point in the series going back to 2014.
Right.
And so now what that means is you have to actually rent the rigs and drill the holes in addition to fracking. And that extra cost of establishing production is something that we expect to weigh on production growth in the U.S. in 2024. Now, it certainly helps when oil is at 85 than when it is at 70 or 75, like it was a year ago. And I think that that's gotten me a little bit more optimistic about the U.S. And our forecast actually calls for prices to fall by $3 or $4, even while OPEC production remains at its current levels, because OPEC has decided over the past 2 years to bring in quite substantially their oil production. They have, in effect, ceded market share to non-OPEC producers, especially the U.S., where most of that production is going. It's they are the levels of excess capacity, meaning how much oil production Saudi Arabia could bring online. And really, I mean, it's OPEC's spare capacity, but Saudi Arabia, it counts for the lion's share of that. That excess capacity stands at above 5 million barrels per day. That is historically very high. It has been very difficult historically for the cartel to maintain this level of discipline for such a long period of time. But they have signaled to the market that they don't intend to unwind production cuts, at least in the foreseeable future. That has caused oil prices to rise. That's been the main contributor to the rise in oil prices. Also, we've gotten past a period of weak seasonal demand. Also, there's geopolitical concerns with the war between Israel and Hamas and how that might conflagrate and spread to Iran-Israel conflict as well. So there's really a number of factors that have contributed to the rise in oil prices. But that, you know, an old adage, the cure for high prices is high prices. So it has given producers the opportunity to establish new sources of production. And I feel good about the U.S. adding maybe 300,000 barrels per day to a 500,000 barrels per day in 2024. And I would say if you asked me the same question a couple months ago, I would have said, you know, 250,000 to 350,000 barrels would be my estimate. So there is kind of a silver lining to the increase in oil prices that we've experienced in recent months.
Okay, so what you're saying is last year production increased dramatically in the shale fields because they had all these DUCs sitting out there. The what does that stand for?
Drilled but uncompleted. Yes.
Yeah. And they just took them out of mothballs. They fired them up and produced a million barrels more of oil a day. That's done. They can't. The inventories of DUCs are a record low. They can't really go there anymore. But prices are up. We're in the high 80s, and according to the Dallas Fed, break even is $70. So that's, you can make real money, you know, at that, at the current price. And therefore, they're going to start drilling more wells, putting more rigs in the ground, and start investing more because they can make money at doing it. And they feel reasonably confident because OPEC is not going to start pumping a lot of oil. In all likelihood, the Saudis are going to keep production where it is, and they can feel reasonable. There's no confidence in this at all, but there's reasonably confident that they're going to get that price.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like what becomes more imperative is the Baker Hughes rig counts. And they were kind of less important in 2023. They were actually, into the weeds a little bit more. They're actually an input into the EIA's model to forecast real-time oil production on a weekly basis. There's a weekly petroleum status report that comes out every Wednesday at 10:30, and they estimate U.S. production. And part of an input into that model is Baker Hughes rig counts. And so the EIA was estimating low levels of production because no one was drilling in 2023. But in fact, production from the hard data was substantially higher because they were using DUCs to establish new sources of production. They weren't drilling as much. I think now with the inventory of DUCs depleted, the rig counts become a little bit more important than they have been over the past 9 months or so. That's not to say that DUCs can't continue to fall. Mm. It's just that it becomes much harder to rely on that as a source of production when inventory levels are so low.
Have you noticed any pickup in rig counts yet?
I mean, not substantially. So just a little bit, but it's something that I'm keeping a close eye on.
Yeah. And you expect it to happen?
I think it will happen. I think, you know, especially with what's happened over the past month and a half or so, that it and it does take some time for it to show up in rig count. So basically the sequencing is that prices have to rise. You know, a CEO has to decide we're going to drill more. 2 months later, after they make that decision, you would see it in rig counts. And then in additional 2 to 3 months, you would see it in actual hard production data. So there's a bit of kind of like sequencing that we have to go through. We haven't really felt the full effects of the recent rise in oil prices on rigs and subsequently drilling, but it's going to play out over the spring and into the summer.
Of course, the other fact, and you mentioned this, but just to put a finer point on it, the unrest in the Middle East, you can notice day-to-day movements in oil prices are closely related to events in the Middle East. I mean, right now they feel a little bit juiced because of the concern that Iran is going to retaliate for the Israeli bombing that occurred a week or two ago. And everyone's kind of on edge and, you know, wondering what that means. What kind of premium is built into the price for that kind of, let's call it geopolitical risk, do you think?
Yeah, I think it is substantial. I mean, I think it's around $4 to $5 per barrel. Just because Iran is a major oil producer and, you know, we're moving into this conflict situation. And then there's also like the impending invasion of Rafah, which could cause geopolitical issues for Israel as well. So I think the market participants are viewing this, and they're viewing the attacks on oil containers that are moving through the Red Sea, and they're assigning a risk premium on that. I mean, and it's not just the premium, but like it also affects dollars and cents, because many shippers have chosen to go around the Cape of Good Hope instead of travel through the Red Sea. And that adds not a huge amount of time and money to shipping routes, but I mean, it has a marginal effect, maybe of a dollar or two per barrel because of the transportation has gotten more expensive.
Okay. All right. Okay. The bad news is that gas prices are going up. That's kind of baked in. It's going to happen because of the as you get into the summer months, the so-called crack spreads, the margins that refiners get will rise, and it reflects the gas the mix of gas that has to be produced. The good news is that you think we're at the peak in terms of oil prices, because we will get more production, particularly coming out of the shale fields, that will be sufficient to meet the demand. And even more fundamentally, there's still a lot of excess capacity out there. So if prices start to rise to any significant, if we get into the 90s, then the economic pressure for OPEC to start cheating on its quotas will be such that we'll get more oil. That's in a nutshell what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And people like Iraq are more likely to cheat in that scenario. I do think the range for Brent is between 75 and 95. And I would agree that we're at the higher end of that range currently.
Yeah. You know, it's we forecast lots of stuff. Some I feel pretty confident in, like inflation is going back to the Fed's target. Some not so much, like oil prices, which you know, a lot of intrepidation there. Okay, let's play anything else on oil. We didn't even go into natural gas, but we're getting long in the tooth here. Any other burning points you want to make, Chris, before we move on and play the stats game?
No, I mean, I think so we have, there's uncertainty with the forecast, but we are forecasting for prices to kind of tread water and fall down. And yeah, I mean, that's it in a nutshell. And I'm happy to play the game.
Okay, let's play the game, the stats game. We each put forward a statistic. The rest of the group tries to figure that out through questions, deductive reasoning, clues. The best stat is one that is not so easy we get it quickly, one that's not so hard we never get it, one that is apropos to the topic at hand is really, really good. And Marissa, you're up. You always lead on the stats game, so here's your chance. What's your stat?
Okay, my stat is 7.37%.
Second significant digit. Is that important the second significant digit? It is. Oh, okay.
I think so.
Okay.
Is it a rate?
Inflation related?
Not directly, indirectly.
Year over year?
No.
Is it a growth rate?
No.
Is it a share?
No.
Oh my gosh. It's not a share. It's not a growth rate. It's not a percent of any type.
Is it mortgage rates?
Yes, it's the prevailing mortgage rate at the end of the day. It is a percent.
Yeah.
But you see how she does that? It's just not fair what she's doing. I object. Strenuously
what do you
object
to?
I say, is it a percent? And you delay.
I didn't say no.
That's my point. You didn't say yes.
So the number I put forward was 7.37%. Yes, it's 8%. I thought that went without saying.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I apologize.
Answer the question.
Bow down. I didn't hear the percent. It was a percent. Okay.
Oh, okay.
I missed it. Sorry. Anyway.
I did say it.
You did. I'm sure you did.
Yeah.
Did she say it, guys? Did she say it? Did she actually say it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. All
right. Okay.
Roll the tape. Okay. Well, that's a good one. The fixed mortgage rate. Why'd you pick that?
Yeah. I mean, it's back up above 7%. It is jumped on the CPI report, along with bond yields in general, when the CPI report came out. So definitely, and we didn't really talk about this, what our expectations are for what the Fed is going to do, but the expectation now is in the market is that there won't be a rate cut soon, right? There won't be a rate cut in the next couple of months, given the hotter inflation data. So this sent the 10-year treasury yield higher, this sent mortgage-backed security yields higher, this sent the mortgage rate higher, all up the curve.
Yeah.
Not good.
Not good. What do you think, Chris? 7.37, what kind of damage is that going to do to the housing market?
You know, you're still out of the money, right? You were out of the money before. Yeah. So I don't know that it doesn't help, certainly, but I don't know that it changes a lot of the supply dynamics, but more on the affordability side, right? So it's,
those, I kind of think of it,
if there's a psychological break going, you know, like jumping above 7 when it went above, like people have these whole numbers in their mind and.
That was my thought. I think anything over 7, the market goes into a deep freeze. Mm-hmm. Anything south of 6, it feels like life comes back to the market. Yeah, but yeah, that's a good one. Good one. Good one, Matt. Good get. Why don't you go next, Matt? You're up next.
4.7%.
CPI related?
No.
PPI?
No.
Inflation related?
Tangentially.
Labor market related?
Yes.
Okay.
Wages for something?
Yeah, Atlanta Fed wage tracker.
Yeah, that's right. Oh. Atlanta. Yeah, yeah. So the 3-month moving average of annual wage growth as measured by the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta.
How well do you know that data?
The composition of it?
Just how it's constructed. Anything? Do you have a good sense of the data?
I know that it's timely and I often reference it because for that reason, but it's down from 5% in February to 4.7% in March. It's the lowest rate since late 2021. So I think that's a positive story. I mean, very hard to continue having these, you know, above target inflation if wage growth continues to lower and lower. So I think it's a good story there. It's still too high, but it's trending in the right direction. And you know, in a week of not the most encouraging data, I think that was a positive spot.
Doesn't the Atlanta Fed track individual workers, right? And they, I think from the CPS data, is it CPS data?
They use the CPS.
Yes. That sounds right. Yeah.
And they calculate a median, right? So they look at the entire distribution and then they look at the median in that distribution. They do 3-month moving average and they do 12-month moving average.
Yeah.
Something like that to smooth out the volatility, because I'm sure there's a fair amount of volatility,
right?
Which is, you know, the control for mix issues, right? Because you're following the same worker, so it makes it valuable. And they also have all these demographic breaks, you know, weight, you know, parts of the wage distribution, male, female, age, switchers versus people who are staying on the job, you know, all those kind of, and then by region, they do it by region as well. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty cool data. The thing though is, does the level of the growth rate matter? I mean, because 4.7% is higher, meaningfully higher than kind of the 4% ish we were getting on the average hourly earnings. And I think the ECI, the Employment Cost Index, which we all look at as well, is, and that's generally taken as the gold standard for wages, for measuring wage growth. That's closer to four by some of the measures. The difference between 4 and 4.7, again, we're going, this whole theme of this whole podcast is we're parsing everything down to decimal points here, but that could be material, right? In terms of, is that consistent with the 2%? What's consistent with a 2% inflation target? 4.7% probably isn't, right? Because 4.7, 2% inflation, let even say 2% productivity growth, that's more consistent with 3% inflation than 2% inflation. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying? So does the level matter here or not?
That's tough to say, but I would say the trend is unambiguous.
Trend is good.
And to me, that's kind of the encouraging part of it. But 4.7% is not what the Fed estimates to be compatible with their targets. So there's that issue, but it's not the primary wage measure they're looking at. But I think the decline, in a pretty consistent decline in the first quarter, is encouraging, levels aside.
Is the Atlanta Fed tracker consistent? Historically, has it always been higher? If you,
no.
If you go back?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Not to my mind's eye.
All right.
The construction of that has its biases in it too. So,
what are they, Marissa?
Well, in order to be counted in there, as you said, they're looking at the same worker, right? Mm-hmm. Like in this month, and then they're going 8 months out and looking at that worker again. You have to have a job in both. They're using the CPS, so you have to be employed in both.
Places,
which. Inherently, there's a bias there because it's not going to pick up on people that are new entrants into the labor force or people that may have been out of the labor force and come back in and are going to get these big wage gains. It tends to oversample older workers, they think, for that reason, people that steadily have like the same job over and over. So that can bias the estimates of wages on that one.
Mm. Is your sense is it would, given in the current context, that it would be biased higher relative to actual?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there's an argument. I'm not sure because I haven't like dug into this, but you could argue it would actually bias it lower because if you are if you're a more experienced worker and you have the same job, you're not getting big increases in your pay year after year, right? You're much more likely to get a big bump in pay if you go from nothing to something, or you switch industries, presumably, or you, so I don't know. I think it could depend on the time period we're in, but I could see an argument for it actually biasing it down too.
Okay. Yeah, this data, this wage tracker has been bothering me a little bit because it's on the high side of, it's not consistent with a 2% inflation target. It's more consistent with a 3% inflation, which is kind of sort of where things are stuck. So if you buy into the Atlanta wage tracker, you're saying, inflation's not going to get back to 2. It's at least not unless the labor market eases up and we get further, you know, deceleration in wage growth here. I mean, all the trend lines look good, as you point out. They're decelerating, which is good. I mean, there's no reason to expect that that's going to stop, but nonetheless, it's been bothering me a little bit. Well, that's a good one. That was a good one. Okay, Chris, L, you're up.
Okay, my number is 24.
24.
Inflation related?
No, it's energy and a little bit politics.
Oh.
24, are there any units on that or?
No.
It is a count.
Or that's what the guess is.
There's 24 of them.
Right.
Yes.
There's 24 of something. Is that right? 24 of something?
Yes.
Energy related political. There's 24 states?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That's right.
24 states where gas prices are above $4.
We're above $4, but that's incredible, Mark. Yes.
I love being described as incredible. I love that.
I should get the cowbell out for that one. That was I think
you mispronounced. That's incredulous.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Incredulous. Yeah.
There were 24 states in which gas prices were $4 or more 2 months before the last midterm election, in which the Democrats did well. I'm trying to give you a little bit of solace, Mark, because gas prices, I know, are a key factor in our presidential election model, and they could swing the election one way or the other. And so I went back at the last midterm election to determine how many states were gas prices above $4 a gallon, and it was 24. I think by all intents and purposes, the midterm election was either a draw or a win for the Democrats, based on basically what the polls were indicating. So I think that it is certainly something for us to pay very close attention to in terms of the elections that are coming up in November. But regardless of the energy climate, I think that there's still some substantive issues that will decide the outcome of the election.
So what's your gas price forecast for November for the election?
$3.62.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh. Okay.
And there was a tipping point in the election model, Mark, where
Brendan, our colleague who has been working on this with Justin Begley, Brendan Lacerda, calculated it's $4.09. So if oil prices average $4.09 for 3 months, not for a day or a week, so that means it's going to be well into the fours, and I would think, for some period of time. All else being equal, that flips the election results. We are currently, given Chris's forecast of $3.62, forecasting Biden wins with 308 electoral votes. But if it goes to 409 on average in the second quarter of the year, then we're all else equal, it goes to Trump. Trump will win. So that's how close it is.
That 409 was January, February approval ratings and consumer sentiment type of inputs too. Do we think that has changed?
No, it's all else equal. I mean, for consumer sentiment and approval, we're just taking the current value as the forecast.
Okay.
No change there. But the approval rating doesn't matter in the model. I mean, it's very, and consumer sentiment doesn't matter all that much either.
Conference board, is that in?
That's in the, yeah, but yeah. You have to go read the paper. I don't want to go down the rabbit hole, but
sure.
It's not, those aren't particularly useful, in trying to understand how this thing. The other thing that will swing it, though, is mortgage rates. Anything over 8, that'll swing it, all else equal. And so if you go to, let's say you go to 7.75 and a gas goes to 390, well then, I'm making that up, but the model probably could flip, at that point. Yeah. So it's very close. It's very close. All right, let's do one more. Chris Derides, what's your statistic?
88.5. Is it a participation rate of some sort, or
is it a what? Diffusion index?
No.
Inflation related?
Or Chris, it's not inflation.
Is it a rate?
It's not a rate.
He said a participation rate. That's what Chris said. Chris L. said.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yes, it's not a rate.
It's an index.
It is an index. Came out this week.
ISM didn't come out this week. Oh, is it NFIB?
NFIB.
Small. Hey, I've been pretty hot. I'm killing it.
You're on fire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go on, Marissa. What's going on? It's an off week, Marissa.
I'm letting my boss win.
That's right.
I'm going to see him next week.
Please do. Anytime you want to do that, feel free. Feel free. I have no problem with that. I'm just saying. Yeah. Lefakis would never do that to me, but he'd ground me into the dirt if he could. Yeah.
We'll play the game.
Yeah, yeah.
Best man wins.
All right, Christy, what why'd you pick that one?
It is very low. It's lowest level since December of 2012. Small business owners are nervous. They're, at least according to the survey, they're saying they're not particularly thrilled about the economic prospects. They're feeling pressure on their sales, right? They still have problem hiring, right? Or finding high quality workers. So, you know, something to bear in mind. At least the small business community is signaling that things are not.
Do you read
so
much into that, though? I mean, really, it's like the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey. I think it's got
a political bent to it as well.
Yeah, very political.
Pretty empirically. It's like dramatic swings by who's in the White
really?
House. Yeah. More than the University of Michigan, which they've all become a little bit more partisan, but NFIB.
Yeah,
sure.
I don't know. That's interesting, though. I did notice, I was looking at one of your decks that you put together, that business formation, which has been very elevated since the pandemic hit, that is starting to come off the boil a little bit.
Yes. It's not a whole lot, but it's down.
It's still high. It's still high, but it's coming down a little bit.
It's coming in.
Do you think, I was going to ask another question, but we're already pretty long. I thought we'd end the conversation. I already gave you my stat, the 1.9. So I've played out. So let's go to the last part of the conversation and what this all means for the Federal Reserve and markets. And as we were discussing earlier, the hot 0.4% increase in CPI, core CPI, hair on fire. I think the stock market sold off over 500 points on the Dow. You see the 10-year treasury yield? I think it increased like, I don't know, 20 basis points or something. Mm-hmm. Some crazy increase.
So 5%.
It's a 450, 4.5% on the 10-year.
456.
Is it 456? 456. Let me turn to you, Chris. What did the CPI do to expectations for the Fed? You know, if I go look at the futures markets, what are they saying?
Yeah, push them out. So June had been the, I guess, the mode or the median up until the CPI came out. And now that's off the table. And they're pushing out the expectation to September for the first cut. Looks like two cuts this year, September and December.
Yeah. And what's the probabilities? Any sense of probabilities?
Oh,
if not, no worries. I just
remember, but.
Is it now basically the markets don't think there's any chance for a June rate cut or
1 in 5?
One in five. Okay.
Yeah. And that's the shift from, and it was only about 55% before yesterday's data.
Yeah.
So people were starting, and there was starting to be a shift a little bit away to begin with, but it dropped from majority to 20%.
And is the preponderance of the probability now in September as opposed to, because there's a meeting in July too, right?
Yeah, July is majority is a slight majority is expect another pause. And then in September is when you start to see it tip to the majority of participants. It gets a little convoluted over time where people are going to be, but the majority of investors expect at least one cut in September.
Okay. So it gets over 50% probability at the September meeting.
Right.
Okay. Because I think we'll have to sit down and discuss this, but I think we're definitely going to push out when we have our first rate cut to, I would argue September, right?
Yeah.
In terms of the OER component, does the 7.37% level on the fixed mortgage rate boost that, and to what extent?
No. It's not the mortgage payment, Chris. It's the equivalent rent. Not directly, and not maybe over a long period of time it has some impact, but not directly. I think if you go to the Canadians, the way we used to calculate it here was a mortgage payment. So if the mortgage rate increased, the mortgage payment would increase, and that would show up in the CPI. But that changed here when, Chris, back in the 80s or something.
84, 83.
Yeah, something like that. But the Canadians still do it that way. So you have to be careful when you look at the Canadian data. And the Europeans throw it out altogether. Remember, they harmonized, so they don't pay any attention to it.
UK too.
Yeah.
In terms of financial markets, it looks like the financial, they'll handle it reasonably well, maybe sell off a little bit, but as long as they're convinced that the next move is down instead of up, they'll handle it gracefully. But if for whatever reason they think more hikes would be necessary, then that would be like a DEF CON 4 scenario for financial markets.
Yeah, it's a whole different ballgame. Let me to that end, turn it back to Chris Tsourides. I mean, what would it take for the Fed to actually begin cutting rates? I mean, it feels like to me they're focused on the inflation statistics at this point. They're not really focused on the job numbers anymore. They feel like the job market has cooled off. We are getting very strong job growth, but it's okay because we've got all this labor supply. Unemployment is actually notched a little bit higher here, and wage growth is normalizing. So, you know, they're not worried about that, but they're really worried about the inflation numbers. Are they coming in or not? Are we stuck at 3%? Or are we going to 2%? And what is it, do you think, they would need to see to convince them that, yeah, we are going to 2%, that they're sufficiently so that they start cutting interest rates, which we're saying by September, this is going to happen. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, my sense is they need to see 3-4 months of consecutive trend down in the inflation rate, that we are clearly on the path towards that 2% target, right? No stalling out, just very, it doesn't have to be, you know, immediate, but it need to see those 0.2, 0.1% prints. You got to get that, that direction in there.
Yeah. That's my thought. I mean, I it feels like they need 3 months that kind of average out to 0.18, percent. So that's what they need, right? Something like that. You can get a 0.2, but you need a 0.1 thrown in there, and you need it 3 months in a row. That's how you get to September, right? Because you get an April, May, June. You know, you're going to get one bum month in there, July. That takes you to September, maybe July, maybe. But you got to have pretty good luck here to get 0.2s and 0.1s for the next 3 months.
And I think it has to be definitive to really make the case for July, right? It has to be even more of a downward slope.
I guess that could change if something breaks in the economy or we start to slump, which is possible. I mean, I don't know if you noticed, but our tracking estimate for GDP now is in the low ones. I don't know if you noticed that. So it feels like things have cooled off here pretty significantly coming into.
Yeah, well, the policy misstep is our number one risk, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Sure. Right. Okay. All right. Marissa, anything you want to add on that, on the Fed front? The Fed front? Say that 3 times fast.
No, I just, it's becoming increasingly more difficult for them, I think, to navigate this. And now we're looking at potentially a first move that's right before the election, too.
Oh, that's a great point. That's a great point. I mean, let's say they get the 3 consecutive months of 0.2, 0.1, and now you're looking at September. Maybe you decide to wait till right after the November meeting is right after the election, right?
Right. Yeah.
Do you really want to get
day after or something?
Yeah. Do you really want to get caught up in the politics of that? That's a really interesting point.
But isn't pausing a political consideration for the independent central bank?
Yes.
Great point. Yeah. Great point. But it's easier to not, if you move, that it's different than if you don't move, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess it depends on how it's definitive the data is. If the data is screaming at you, you morons, it's, if we're a target and you're taking a chance here, then they got to go. You're right. But if it's not screaming at them, you're a moron, then maybe they wait.
Yeah.
But I think that the odds that you get that, this very smooth, consistent month after month, deceleration in inflation are low, given what we saw. I mean, you could have made the you did make the argument that they could have moved on the data at the end of 2023 forward rates, and they didn't. Yeah,
they didn't.
And then they'd be in this situation where they would have moved, and then they would have had hot inflation readings, right?
Yeah.
So,
are you arguing for November, December, Marissa?
Well,
for first cut?
No, I'm not arguing that they what they should or shouldn't do. I think what I'm arguing is that I think it's unlikely that they're going to have, from here on out, inflation readings that are 0.3, 0.2, 0.1, 0, you know, I think that's unlikely. And so then they're going to be in this position where, well, it depends how you read it. If you take this out, if you do a 3-month moving average, if you take a 6-month moving average and
you go to the second decimal point,
go to the second decimal point and you round up or you round down, I think it's going to be, I don't think it's going to be as clear cut as
I tell you what though, I suspect it's also not going to be clear sailing on the economy either. Something's going to happen somewhere. We're going to get a really slow, significant. I think the probability that we slow down is much greater than we reaccelerate here. Yeah. And so, or something breaks in the financial system because you've got this inverted curve. The Fed's got its foot on the brake. Mm-hmm. It just feels like, and then you don't, you're going to say, okay, you know, do I really need a 0.18? Maybe I can live with a 0.23, you know, something like that. And I can cut, I don't know. It's going to be interesting, though. Okay. Very good. Anything else, guys, before we call it a podcast? I think that was very informative. And Matt, I was just, you know, pulling your, as it, I think there's a phrase called pulling your chain, right? Isn't that?
I think so.
That there is, yes.
It's funny that when I say these sayings and I start thinking about them, I go, is that really a saying? You know, right. That ever happened to you? Pulling your chain? No.
I think so. I think
it's like, it's, you know, this is the same thing as your password. Once you start thinking about your password, you go, oh, what's my password? I can't think of my password. You know, you go into a panic mode, right? Because you just type it. You don't even think about it. And then once you start thinking about it, you go, oh my gosh, what is it?
Yeah.
Am I just me? Is that just me? Or is that everybody?
I do that with my address, my home address.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah. Like, the street that's numbers, weird. I start questioning when I say it out loud. I'm like, that doesn't sound right. Is it a 4 or a 3?
Something's wrong, Marissa. Something's wrong.
It could be.
Could be.
I do it with my age.
That too. Yeah. Isn't it like the Heisenberg principle or something? Whatever you focus on, you mess with it, you know?
Makes sense, yeah.
I don't think that's a Heisenberg principle.
I don't know. Is that something you just made up?
I could have. Exactly. That's exactly it. All right. Anyway, we're going to call this a podcast. Take care, everyone.